Welcome to the Parents Coaching Parents Network with your host, M.H. Scott. This is a one-hour interactive talk show. We'll talk college recruiting, athletic scholarships, and much more. Here's your host, M.H. Scott.
Hey, this is M.A. Scott from the Parents Coaching Parents Network. This is a pre-recorded show, but I just wanted to let you listen to this clip, parents, because I think there's some interesting dialogue going on with those folks that we identify as our sports analysts and what they think about our children. No, we don't have the rights to this particular clip, but this clip is posted on social media under the Dan Lebatard Show. So if you want to go back and listen to it in this entirety, you by all means, please do. But I want to know your thoughts as a sports parent. So you can post this information on our Facebook page, Parents Coaching Parents Network, or comment in our IG or Twitter account, PCP Network. Folks, we hope to hear from you because we think that this dialogue needs to be addressed on how these sports analysts and sports reporters think of our children. Hey, hope you enjoy the show.
You know how fascinated I was and many people were about the evolution of the super team producing this team of trolls with the Brooklyn Nets that was very easy to dislike from afar, but this guy was in the middle of everything that was happening with that team, and it is indisputably an interesting team.
He was in the middle of them choking.
His book, Can't Knock the Hustle, Inside the Season of Protest, Pandemic, and Progress with the Brooklyn Nets Superstars of Tomorrow. It's available now. Matt Sullivan is with us. Thank you, Matt. And you got close to all this stuff, and this is an unusual team. So let's just start with what you believe to be the most interesting parts of this team and what your reporting uncovered about how interesting the personalities were.
I think it was just complete control from day one, which was 2 years ago this week, you know, what Woj called, quote, the clean sweep. And I just remember not being able to talk to management, talk to coaches, talk to anybody without them kind of being scared of these guys, including Kenny Atkinson, who built this whole program up. He's kind of saying, let's leave KD, the Maserati, in the case. Let's let Kyrie be Kyrie. But then Kyrie goes behind his back and gets him fired. And Kenny Atkinson's wondering, should I fly halfway across the country private with this guy and take a game off just to go to second, third, fourth opinions with him? And then he gets the axe. And then all of a sudden, the Nets are kind of, I wouldn't say tanking, but disappearing from the bubble, while KD was ready. He was ready to go in the bubble, but Kyrie and him were kind of planning their own thing. And so they've taken control of player empowerment in a way that I think, obviously, the movement goes back to the decision, and so does my book, kind of underlying this crazy history book I fell into the last two seasons. But I just think they've got an iron grip on this thing, and even Steve Nash is kind of having to lean back and play babysitter.
How did you get embedded?
I kind of knocked down the door, made friends with these guys, and asked them questions that your average beat reporter refuses to ask. I mean, I was asking about race, the anthem, police shootings in the locker room while other guys were asking about X's and O's. And I think that was why Kyrie and I had a weird bond over real talk, to the point where he's up in my DMs sending me 67-page Supreme Court rulings on indigenous land rights. And I'm like, okay. And this is at the same time when I'm asking him, did you just skip the national anthem? Because I was just noticing this stuff off the court. The book doesn't really have a lot of on-court stuff at all. And they were skipping the anthem, he and KD, all of this season.
He was smoking the entire time, right?
Well, I think KD would be the one who was probably smoking while Kyrie was burning the sage. I think that's kind of how they balance out.
What are some of the things that you learned that people don't know? Because you got awfully close to this thing.
I'd say Kyrie's actually not that crazy so much as trying to find himself. he keeps saying that I'm relatively young as my life goes. Maybe I'm on the back half of my career, but he wasn't just buying a house for George Floyd's family. He wasn't just out here putting James Baldwin posts on his Instagram. He'll do these random acts of kindness, if you will, left, right, and center. He just doesn't take credit for it. Like, there was a kid 2 weeks ago who got shot in California, tells his doctor randomly, you know, Kyrie Irving's my favorite player. The doctor on a lark reaches out to Kyrie's team, and now he's buying that kid a house, disability approved and all that. So I think he's a good guy who just can't articulate himself. And so the more I talk to him, you know, on and not on the record, he displayed a human affection, a fatherhood, but also a fed-upness, if you will, about the world. And so that whole quote-unquote pause he took, and he gets caught in the maskless video of this family party, he basically took that pause, you know, partly paternity leave, which is cool, but also precipitated by the Capitol riot, by there being no charges for Jacob Blake. So I think he's brought out that conversation into the forefront, like mental health, this is just a day job, but he's living it every day whenever he damn pleases.
We have not heard Kyrie and KD skipping the anthem. What do they say about that?
It's a private decision. They're not going to be out here like Kaepernick was originally, kind of staking their claim. It's more of just Hoopers are sick of the anthem, right? And it took a reporter to notice Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf skipping the anthem back in the day, kind of the original Kaepernick. It took a reporter to notice Kaepernick and get him to speak out and really become an activist. So I noticed, but I think the arc of the anthem may have been so watered down in terms of kneeling and Cap's protest kind of becoming meaningless that weekend in 2017 when Trump went after Cap, Trump went after the Warriors, and then even Jerry Jones is taking a knee by the end of the weekend. But the NBA was freaked out that back then, up from Adam Silver on down, that NBA players were going to hurt the bottom line by taking a knee. I think Kyrie, KD, a lot of other players in these kind of shrinking phalanxes while the anthem's playing just don't give a damn anymore. And so I don't think they're trying to make a statement so much as just not be with it anymore.
Matt, give us something about Kevin Durant that would surprise us.
He smokes even more weed than you would think. and like I was at his house at 1 o'clock in the morning. The entire place just reeks. But he also just really cares about hoop. Like we were talking sneakers, there was a little party going around, and all he wanted to do was show me his iPhone video of his Achilles recovery, because that's really all he cares about. Like he doesn't have a girlfriend. He doesn't go on crazy vacations. When he has the, you know, I'm me, I do me, and I chill, that kind of is him. But he also flexes a lot behind the scenes. Like he also really tried to get Kenny Atkinson out of there, Steve Nash in there. They were chilling the whole time of like the bubble when they said they were doing this quote unquote search for, you know, Jacques Vaughn and diversity during the Summer of Reckoning. And he was chilling with Steve Nash on Manhattan Beach. And he knew he was the guy. And I think the big thing is that Steve can have this kind of, there's a secret motto the Nets have had this past season, quote, protect the group. And I think that's what Steve is there for, is to lean back and let these guys be them, babysit when they can, but also, you know, come down on guys and say, look, your buddy DeAndre Jordan is washed. He's not going to get these minutes that he used to get just to keep you guys happy. So it's a balancing act there. And I think KD hasn't quite flexed every muscle and is willing to lean back a little, just like, you know, the 75-year-old man James Harden does when he just passes and sits on the three-point line, not shooting anymore.
Why is he so sensitive?
He is sensitive. He wears it on his sleeve, but he's still weirdly out here being aggressive in his DMs. And I don't think that's changed since he was in the Bay. And, you know, I talked to Steve Nash for a while about this, and he said he took KD out for a drink when he was just kind of sick of KD, you know, being up in his DMs, the burner accounts and all that. And he takes him out. He kind of prepares the lesson and he says to KD, you know what I respect about LeBron? I respect that when he got to Miami, he got sick of the narrative, sick of the haters, all the talk. So you know what he did? And KD kind of sits there like, what's that, coach? You know, has a sip of his drink. And Kerr says, LeBron just said, can I curse on here?
Yes.
LeBron just said, fuck it. And then he was great again. Same with Michael, with Kobe, all the greats. So they had to say, fuck it. And then they were all on that next level. So you know what you have to do? And KD leans back and says, what's that, coach? Go out and be you. You just got to say, fuck it, like LeBron did. But then, even though the Warriors kind of rolled from there, Steve's telling me that, you know, he tried to get KD to stop looking at his phone all the time, to stop, you know, beefing with Draymond and then beefing with kids on Twitter. And he said, you know, I tried, but I failed. I could just see the strain on his face every day, especially that third year, just all day. But it was really, he was staring into that phone all the time. So he can't get over this. I mean, he says he's beyond it, but he's out here having, you know, GOAT top five debates and making sure he's in that conversation. So I don't think he's really changed since the Bay. And the only difference is that, you know, Brooklyn lets him be him and doesn't, you know, get in his face about it like Kerr did.
They're totally left alone. The power has reached a point where these brands and these economies, these guys are answering to largely no one.
Yeah, a very high-ranking official with the Nets who had a lot to do with the money said basically it was a blank check as soon as these guys got here, whether that's buying a girlfriend or a girlfriend on the side of a house in California for a week, whether that's just putting up money for the boys and the homeboys and equipment for random shit. They're totally cool with that. And so I think that's what makes the Nets a modern franchise. It's not their fancy practice facility or their defensive schemes. It's just that they're willing to put up with this. And maybe the Clippers weren't able to do that when they kind of pulled that, you know, clean sweep 2.0 that weekend 2 years ago. And so they've had some difficulty transitioning to that, where Ty Lue comes in and kind of does what Steve Nash has had to do, is just be like, okay, whatever, let him hoop and figure out some sets and we'll get these guys healthy in a room together.
Forgive me, I don't think I understood. What do you mean buying a girlfriend a house?
Just renting a house on the team dime. These guys don't pay for a lot of personal stuff themselves. And so the financial team of the Nets would kind of come every week or so. They'd be like, okay, like, we thought we had this under control. We had to redo the budgets every week. And they were like, it was just a new thing every damn time.
I haven't heard any of this stuff. Now, you've done hundreds of interviews, and this is a thoroughly reported thing. You're an award-winning editor from Bleacher Report and Esquire. The things you're saying, though, that seems, among other things, like a salary cap violation. I don't believe you're allowed to just rent girlfriends' homes on the team's dime. That sounds like something that, when people find out about it, is going to incur penalties. That's not kosher, I don't think.
There's a lot of things that the Nets do that aren't kosher. There's a reason they have this kind of Kremlin-esque wall around everything they do. During the middle of COVID, they were working out half the team, well, really Kyrie, KD, and their friends on the team, out in Kobe's old gym in California. You weren't allowed to do that during COVID. You had to have all these strict protocols, one coach, one this, masks, gloves on while you touch the basketball. But they were running like a secret camp the whole time, trying to get KD and Kyrie in shape. And from what I understand, from what some people told me, is also articulating who they wanted on this team, kind of puppeteering, watching some of these young guns in the bubble, basically letting them lose and figuring out who they wanted to keep on the super team. You know, all the while Kyrie's painting and saging and, you know, tweeting or Instagram posting manifestos about, you know, Black Lives Matter and why he doesn't believe in that mainstream movement, from his car outside of Kobe's gym before he goes and does these secret runs with what would become the super team, including James Harden, who ended up in that gym too while they formed this team on election day, while Chris Paul was also around.
Are you at all worried about KD and Kyrie's response to this?
I think they're happy to act like this book doesn't exist, because they know there's a lot of stuff that is just the real them, the real franchise. And If they choose to have their Kremlin wall of silence, that's cool. I think KD understood that this book from the beginning, and I was really upfront with him. You know, I wasn't going to tweet during the season. I wasn't going to let all this out of context. And if we did this unvarnished look, it could really be a look at power and fame and race and social, and not all the shit that's been written about them ad nauseum. So I just left a lot of that backstory about them and, frankly, their personal lives out of the book, and just kind of looked like, okay, how do these guys take their force field and, you know, impose their will to get what they want out of life, but also out of their careers before they're over?
What's most likely to upset them?
I think this anthem thing is annoying to them, honestly, just because they didn't want to get found out. And that's fine. I think the whole Kenny Atkinson firing, where KD kind of brought the, you know, sky of easy money sniper down at the last minute, you know, they would just as soon say, oh, it was a mutual parting of ways. But it's okay. Like, I don't mind pissing them off because this is just the unvarnished truth about who they are and their control. But I think it, you know, if you read the whole thing, you get a pretty fair picture of Kyrie. I don't think he's been given that space to be loved and, you know, eyebrow rolled at the same time. And I think this thing makes him look like a good man and KD look like the true hooper that he is, who's ready to build this dynasty that's been on hold for a while now.
What's most likely to bother the Nets and the NBA?
I think the NBA would be pissed off that I found out how desperate the Knicks were to lure KD to the point where he'd already made up his mind, like earlier than the quote unquote two max slots Zapruder tape. KD had been at Kyrie's place in Boston, and they'd been, you know, eating over wine and vegan burgers and vegan smoothies, playing as themselves on 2K, and just kind of, they weren't happy where they were, and they were ready to make their move. So KD had basically made up his mind to play in Brooklyn while he was playing in the finals with the Warriors, which is fine. That's his prerogative. These guys text all the time. I'm sure it wouldn't make the Warriors happy. But then he'd already made up his mind, and still, before free agency opens, before that quote-unquote clean sweep, KD's dad gets a Zoom invite from Steve Mills and Scott Perry, wherever they're existing in Knicks purgatory these days, just desperately trying to get KD to come. And KD has already made up his mind, and his dad texts him, you know, talking about Brooklyn, says the Knicks is Mecca. If you want to do it big. If you want to be a New Yorker, be a Knick. And KD's basically like, don't fuck with my plan here. Don't get me in trouble. And dad shot back, like, are you doing this for Kyrie just because he's your buddy? And KD said, no, I'm doing this for myself. So again, these guys have the power. They know it. They try not to break the rules. Some people do. Some people get caught. But I think the NBA is honestly looking the other way on all this stuff and just accepts player empowerment as the lay of the land. And, you know, throwing out a tacit fine here and there is nothing to KD with his $300 million Nike contract.
I'm guessing, though, that now that some of this reporting comes out, that there's going to be people discrediting you or finding ways to knock your credibility. What is the retort to that?
I did 400 interviews. I checked every side, like that conversation at the bar. I ran it by KD. I ran it by Steve Kerr. None of this is fake news. When I hear a rumbling that nobody else hears, it's honestly because, you know, the Nets beat reporters, as much as I love them, they do ask the X's and O's questions. This, you know, separation that COVID has provided has really made reporting difficult for guys. And I had all these guys' cell phone numbers. I was marching in the streets of Brooklyn with them. I was meditating on Zoom with players in the middle of COVID. So I'm not saying I'm their buddies, and they might not like what came out, but I was honest with them. This is going to be real. You don't get to read this till it comes out. And, you know, whether I was doing the full money ball or not, it's kind of the anti-money ball in that I don't care about the GM or the X's and O's. But that's what they signed up for, and maybe they don't like it, but it was a historic year. Nobody could have predicted that this went from, you know, the China thing to Kobe dying, and then all of a sudden COVID hits. The Nets have more players test positive than anybody. KD kind of gets this positive test that shakes up the world along with Tom Hanks to be like, holy shit, this is real. But the Nets also got all those tests that nobody was getting, you know, who had COVID as a regular public citizen. And then the protests are going on outside Barclays, which seems great. And the Nets would have you think that they're the epicenter of protests, but they're like shutting down activist advances to do, you know, defunding of the police. So I'm not going to paint a rosy picture just because the Nets want to be this kind of franchise of the future. They could be, but it comes with all the particulars of, you know, normal life.
How did you get the trust of these people?
It just took time. They basically gave me a press pass and said, make friends. You know, we're not going to treat you any differently than any other beat reporter. Ask questions at the press conference and get to know these people. And so soon enough, I just kind of showed up everywhere, every day, you know, hung out in practice on the sidelines, but also at these guys' apartments, at their favorite restaurants, at their hangouts, their bars, their secret bar that I knew they hung out with, helped me reconstruct scenes of them all going there for a very weed-heavy seance after Kobe died. And so reconstructing these scenes based on their trust, it took, you know, 10 more interviews just for one little particular, but they kind of got me there and told me the beginning of a story that I nailed down into a lot of scenes in this, you know, accidental history book.
One of these things when it emerges. The reporting on this is really thorough and is comprehensive. And I don't know what's going to happen next for you, because there's a lot of details in here that people have not heard about before, and I believe are going to be surprised by and not like. I don't know if everyone is ready for the heat that's going to come with this, because some of the stuff in here is not what the marketers would want, the publicists would want, the agents would want, but these people don't have to care about any of that, correct?
Well, Kyrie and KD have basically, you know, they control when they talk to the media and when they don't. Like, the PR people for the Nets are perfectly nice, but they're scared of KD and Kyrie. So if those guys want to talk on their own terms or KD's podcast or whatever, that's fine. But that's not going to stop players from now speaking the truth. And, like, to the point where Kyrie was empowered enough to swat guys off the Nets roster for this season because they didn't necessarily agree with his politics or his view of player empowerment when it came to his kind of bubble boycott call. And, you know, Garrett Temple told me straight up, like, players in a leadership, if you go against what they want you to do, then they won't want you back. And he said, you know, if that's the case, then I don't want to be on this team. And, you know, he ended our kind of conversations for the book by saying, but Kyrie's the enigma of the century. So who the fuck knows?
How many guys did they do that to? How many guys did Kyrie personally run off just because he's running things?
I'd say there's a couple younger guys, you know, Zanin Musa kind of, you know, didn't get on his good graces, and all of a sudden he's gone. And it was a great move. They got Bruce Brown, and, you know, Kyrie's, you know, pseudo GM, pseudo coaching status, which he's very much entitled to, you know, blends with Sean Marks being a really good GM and finding Bruce Brown off the scrap heap. You know, the Joe Harris is off the scrap heap, but clearly KD and Kyrie, as nice guys as they are, as good teammates as they are, you know, they're happy to sell half the team for their buddy James Harden any day of the week.
You're basically saying, right, that all of the people in power with the Nets are either allies or administrative assistants to these guys, that we've never seen anything quite like this, where the guys are legitimately running everything.
Or you just stay out of the way. I mean, if you're Joe Harris, you just make friends with James Harden and find a way to look him in the eye and get your passes from him. But yeah, I mean, just look at what Harden did. I mean, we forget that he was in a COVID-filled strip club one day, and the next day the Nets are trading, what, like, terrible assets for him? What did the Rockets get for James Harden? Rodions Kurucs? He's a guy who wasn't friends with Kyrie. But I don't know. If these guys can swindle their way into another unfair super team, that's great. But it's not a lot of the kumbaya vibes that they were trying to do in Golden State. And I think these guys learned pieces from LeBron, from Steph, and they're bringing it to this kind of do whatever I want show in Brooklyn. And again, it's protect the group. They're insulated to do what they want, and the Nets just let them hoop and be them and go on their pseudo paternity leave meets political statement meets maskless video party and act like it didn't happen. But, you know, that kind of pissed off Nets management too. You know, Kyrie had to apologize. He got his kind of slap in the wrist. You know, I think some stuff got out about, you know, me suggesting that they were going to trade him because of it, which is bullshit. It's just, it's that he's pushed it to the limit, and whether, you know, he can keep pushing it or whether he needs to kind of lean back and this is going to be the year where they vibe on the court and don't have as much drama, who knows? But again, this game and this world is so unpredictable right now that I wouldn't be surprised if the Nets continue to be, you know, really controversial. Whether they turn that into this kind of villainy is another thing, but they accept that, right? Steve Nash even kind of jokingly said in a press conference recently, like, we're the villains. Rawr.
What's KD like when he's high?
He's the same. He's pretty chill. He only smokes in the car because he doesn't want to, I don't know if it's get caught or that's just his happy place. But yeah, the bodyguard / housemate who got in trouble for, like, you know, pushing away PJ Tucker in the playoffs, he's just kind of around and takes him down to the car and they blaze and he comes back and he chills or goes out. But he doesn't do anything other than hoop, like, nothing. He's boring as hell. And so going out to him is just blazing. And, you know, I think they were really happy. DeAndre Jordan told me he was pretty happy that the NBA finally got rid of, again, low-key, everybody forgets this amidst COVID, they got rid of weed testing. And so I think nobody's happier than the Nets with that.
What are the problems and the dysfunction that you witnessed?
It really got bad at the height of Kyrie being out, disappearing from the team when he had his shoulder stuff in late 2019. And the franchise legitimately didn't know where he was. that's not chemistry so much as how do you function. Like, it's not dysfunction, it's just disappearance. And so he kind of was finding himself again. And I think legitimately this, you know, this was Kyrie finding himself as a person, having time, then having time over COVID, but kind of reeling him back into the mix and allowing him to do the protest stuff, do the bubble boycott. None of that got him in trouble with the team. They've just had to figure out, you know, how long the fishing rod is with him and when they can kind of bring him back in. I don't think they have dysfunction when they listen to those three guys. It's when coaches try to impose too many schemes or the front office gets a little too involved that these guys basically flex and say, get off.
Did you hear the conversation between Kyrie and Bill Russell talking about fans in Boston, or was that recreated from the reporting?
So I recreated this scene where he's in the gym, summer of 18. He's gotten hurt. He's kind of goes on vacation to Vegas with KD and their entourages. He's trying to rehab in Jamal Crawford's little shitty gym in Seattle. And Bill Russell would come in every day, and like tons of people in the room told me he would just kind of pull up, watch these guys play to 125 in the bleachers in his, you know, with his cane, and then sit down. They would talk about the freedom rides. They would talk about being empowered players. They'd talk about politics, just sitting around campfire style. But then KD and Kyrie would go off onto the side, right? Kyrie and Mr. Russell would go off onto the side. And from what I understand from friends who were around Kyrie all that summer, you know, talked about that classic kind of mindset that Bill Russell had of, you know, I thought of myself as playing for the Celtics, not for Boston. And so his thinking at that time, according to literally his best friend who was living with him in Seattle that summer and went on this vision quest to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation shortly thereafter, said, quote, it was like this power shift going on in Boston, you know, in terms of Jalen and Jason and minutes and those guys shining without him. And then he also realized, and this is him kind of quoting Kyrie's mindset, wait a minute, I'm trying to champion Boston, but now that I'm looking at the history of Boston, is this a city that I want to champion in terms of their racial history and stuff like that? Is Boston the type of place I want to represent? So that was gestating, and then his grandfather died and changed the whole dynamic of him signing long-term, and then he was basically over it by January 2019. But it's also interesting that, you know, as a man, as an activist, really, those ideas are gestating in his head to the point where, you know, he's asked by Rachel Nichols whether he's ready to go back to Boston. He says, well, I hope there's no casual racism. It's the same sentiment. But I also think he's right when he pushes these buttons. It's a far cry from the flat earther shit. But he's come full circle, no pun intended, maybe, to push that button. And then, look, he's right. You know, over the next 2 weeks, superstars are getting bottles and popcorn thrown at him all over the place. So I think Kyrie's a lot more right about this stuff than people give him credit for. But it's because he has these heady conversations, and it's like Kobe. Kobe was big on this stuff, just taking in lessons and asking questions of the great ones and not being afraid to call a spade a spade.
Where did the story of Jay-Z yelling at Adam Silver come from?
Oh, man. That one paragraph took me like 40 interviews to get right, because it wasn't the Nets so much forcing black and white on the league so much as it was weird that the league didn't want black and white in their uniforms. And it got to the point where everyone was asking, like, okay, is there really data that says dark blue looks better in TV? And, you know, an official, a high-ranking executive with the Nets said, you know, you say that to Jay-Z and you get, excuse me? Like, what do you mean that doesn't look good on black players? All of a sudden it goes from being a marketing thing to being a race thing. So, yeah, Adam Silver was then the deputy commissioner in charge of stuff like this. And Jay, from what I understand, like, really flexed hard on him. They didn't bring Jay in to do a lot of stuff like this. You know, he'd, quote unquote, created the Nets identity because he was basically the only superstar around because he failed to, you know, seal the deal with Melo back in the day and got stuck with, you know, some B-list, quote unquote, A-listers. But they, like, the Nets paid off some logo designers $20,000 to say that Jay-Z created the identity. They didn't even know if Jay-Z was going to wear the new Nets jersey at the first show to start off Barclays Center. So there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. There's a lot of image building with the Nets from day one. And it's come full circle now, right? Like, I saw Jay and Beyonce for the first time since, I think, the game where they met the other Royals, Kate and William, the night that there was the I Can't Breathe t-shirts and the Eric Garner protests outside. So there's a lot of eerie foreshadowing. And now we're at the point where finally Jay and Bay showed up again to watch the Nets be amazing against the Bucks. and then have this season slither away from them.
Where and how and what did you learn about Nets management spying on protesters?
So this was after the Hong Kong thing, right? And Joe Tsai had been heavily, heavily criticized for basically siding with Chinese national politics, and the players have been in trouble with not speaking out or not really wanting to. And some officials told me that Joe Tsai was pretty pissed off when he discovered that there were some protesters coming into the arena. It was a big group of pro-Hong Kong activists, and he was in a difficult situation, but they could find out through Ticketmaster who was buying 100 random tickets. And they, you know, basically surveilled on someone to know that the protesters were coming. And the protesters were smart. They snuck in this, you know, Mori or money sign with the perfectly sized, you know, cards that you can put together into a composite sign. And apparently Joe Tsai was really pissed off that that's the NBA rule and that they couldn't catch all these protest signs coming in.
The Nets didn't believe, the players didn't believe that COVID was real. How many of them?
I tried to nail the team doctor down on that. I don't want to name names, but there were some players who would come up to him and kind of joke with him, but then be serious, like, I don't know about all this. And so the doctor said, you know, we needed to approach the unknown, and it takes a lot of convincing. This is the same thing that doctors have a lot of problems with Kyrie. Like, he didn't want to get surgery. They had to convince him that it was okay, that they weren't going to, you know, break his body like he'd been worried about the Cavs doing and LeBron calling him soft, you know, a couple of years earlier. So I honestly think it was okay at that time that people were having trouble confronting it. And I think it's, you know, similar kind of mindset perhaps to getting the vaccine. There's systemic questioning of the system having to do with health and things like this. And people were scared. But I think it's, you know, speaks a lot to the Nets having these characters who are willing to push buttons. And then lo and behold, they're sitting in San Francisco after, you know, the Rudy Gobert incident. And they're thinking, you know, they were going to play the first game without fans against the Warriors. And then that got, you know, shut down because of Rudy. And they're kind of sitting there having it all unfold in real time. And the doctors were really worried when they were flying back from the Bay to go get these kind of notorious tests that they got, because there were reports of people like coughing, runny noses. And, you know, then you had KD and a bunch of the team really quite sick.
What did you learn about the NBA not being quite as liberal as we think of the NBA as, not quite as progressive as we think of the NBA?
Well, it does go back to, you know, Silver not wanting them to take a knee. It goes to the China stuff, which, you know, Republicans yell about, you know, get woke or go broke. But money matters there. There were billions at stake in China. And flash forward to a year later, and, you know, I wrote this story for GQ the other day, that there's kind of two forces of good coming out of the NBA. There's the very corporate, you know, plans that in the aftermath of the Bucks boycott, which, you know, Kyrie was kind of right all along of whether it was a good look to be out there making billions for Disney and ESPN when you could have been fighting in the streets. But the outcome of that kind of chaos in the bubble was LeBron and CP basically getting on the phone with Obama and him telling them to build a policy team so they're not caught on their heels the next time, you know, sadly inevitable tragedy rolls around. And so they're working on that, you know, kind of official committee lobbying in Washington, but it's safe, right? They're happy to go with the bipartisan compromise on policing reform, on even voting reform, just to have this kind of buttoned up league office look. And then there's still the Kyrie. I mean, it's not that divided. It's just there are players who do their own thing. And then there's, you know, Kyrie taking his days off and buying houses for people and, you know, still going that kind of bubble boycott kind of way as the enigma of the century and being upset with the, you know, corporatized way of doing things. I don't think Kyrie's been that present of an NBPA union vice president, but that's okay. He's, you know, holds that power so that he can flex it elsewhere. The NBA remains kind of buttoned up despite, you know, having a lot of press releases. I'm not saying the intentions aren't in the right place for the league and its leadership and the PA and Michelle Robertson and Adam Silver. They are the most liberal sports league. But why don't they just retire the anthem then if these guys aren't going for the anthem? I mean, what do you think about that, Dan? You think the NBA could take a masterstroke like that when they've got these billions of dollars of ESPN on the line and don't want to piss off Americans in China?
I think they've got too many white customers who disagree and they would rather lean on their employees there and make sure to placate you know, it's not necessarily Republicans buy shoes too, but you're in a position where your customer base can already at every point during the history of the league be made uncomfortable by the black guys having too much power. And I have been surprised that business has won there, but I'm not surprised that a largely white ownership group would not allow the black players to take away the anthem.
I mean, I thought it was really cool, though, how Cuban just low-key told his stadium operators to stop playing the anthem before the game. And, you know, the NBA quoted the, you know, unique circumstances of the season, like, oh, that's okay. We'll allow that. And then, as you're saying, that kind of white audience, the blowback, they're like, well, you know what? Everybody's got to do the anthem this year. We take it back. So that's exactly the safe, yet, you know, woke nature of the NBA. Is it really progressive? Is it really leftist? Is it really pushing the culture that direction? I think it's the players doing that, not the league and its press release reality.
What did you learn about Kyrie Irving saying he was coming back to Boston and then not coming back to Boston?
Well, he had that vision quest that summer with Bill Russell, and he went to Standing Rock to kind of reconnect with his roots. His mom was from there. He'd learned all this stuff about his mom and kind of, you know, connected with his grandfather, who he said, you know, she's with him now in terms of the spirit. And so, yes, he made that promise to Boston fans, but he told KD later that, you know, once his grandfather died, everything else in life wasn't important to me. And so I think that's when this whole basketball doesn't have to be my life thing began. And Boston, you know, had on-court issues for sure, but I think he was just over it. And he wanted to come home, and he's a Jersey kid, grew up a Nets fan. It was summoning him home. And he, you know, he had a daughter he wanted to build a house for. And I think that's why KD followed him, not the other way around.
Whatever awards they give away for writing, Matt, I'm telling you, you might win a few, you know?
It's amazing. Yes. Stugatz all of a sudden cares about reporting and, more importantly, cares about not having to read this because you've given him the clip notes. Yeah. But I'm sure there's more that we have not gotten to, and I'm sure this will help him sell his book, and I'm sure GQ has helped him sell his book. I am interested in what's going to happen with blowback to you, Matt, because there is going to be some skepticism, even though your reporting seems thorough. And I'm curious who's going to not support what it is you're saying. I'm curious if KD might hit you with some of the stuff that he's hit Jackie McMullen with, where this framing makes it seem like we're not friends, like we're friends, but we're not friends. It sounds like you got a lot closer to KD than anybody does.
He wasn't around that much. I wouldn't say I'm friends with anybody, nor do I want to be, because I'm a journalist who has, you know, no vested interest in my relationship with Rich Kleiman in 2 years. And so I can do, you know, diligent reporting on his investments in Silicon Valley entrepreneurs saying, you know, that's basically a press release too. They're not that involved, despite, you know, the veneer of the boardroom being this great thing. And, you know, they cashed out on Postmates. That's great. But I don't think KD's been, I think he's been told to just kill it with silence. And I think the blowback that I might get, yes, there's Celtics fans, there's, you know, diehard Nets fans that they would never trade Kyrie. Well, some people were pissed off, and you're not getting that from the typical NBA journalist. And, you know, I'm like a real journalist who got into sports a couple of years ago, but I've investigated every police killing in America. You know, I've freed a woman from prison. And that's what helped me ingratiate me with these players, is they knew I was a real person. But just because I don't tweet about, you know, every press release from the NBA or haven't been in locker rooms for my entire life doesn't mean I'm not legitimate here. And like I said, I didn't let any cats out of the bag for 2 years. And so I used to, you know, edit Howard Beck. I used to edit Jonathan Abrams, your guy Haberstroh. Like, we started our own pirate ship as kind of Grantland 2.0 at BR Mag, at Bleacher Report, for a couple of years before they excised journalism themselves, which is, you know, good for people who don't like to read. But I think, you know, I've been exploring this world, doing stories on Cap since the beginning, and this is kind of the culmination of a lot of my thinking, from, you know, this scourge of police violence to the rise of player empowerment and how those, you know, real world issues collide with power and fame. And if that comes with blowback from the rich and famous, or the trolls of individual teams, so be it. I have altered my mentions a little in the last couple of weeks and the notifications I get from Twitter. So if you guys want to tweet at me, I will see it. If the random guys who, I did get an at mention from the guy who KD went at. It's like this 24-year-old teacher from Kentucky who KD went at, like, I don't know if he's drunk or not, from a Kanye Rock Nation concert back in the day. And this guy's like, I guess that moment changed my life, but does this guy really have to go after me? I'm just a school teacher in Kentucky.
What is the kind of detail that you think the audience would enjoy learning about the lifestyles of the rich and famous that you entered here?
They're not that exciting. I think you get the veneer of social media and these guys, player first platforms for media. They spend a lot of time in hotels. They really miss their kids. They don't have serious, long-term relationships or a lot of love in their life. And they're really worried about their bodies and they'll protect them at all costs. And then you get a guy like Spencer Dinwiddie, who's a, superstar of this book, who spends his off days with 10 lawyers coming at the league saying, I can IPO my own contract, or, I can start this creator galaxy without hurting my brand. And so, I can make my own sneakers, even though it's going to piss off Nike and Adidas. And I think he's, the book has a very long subtitle or whatever, but that when it said like the superstars of tomorrow, I don't necessarily mean, the future of 75-year-old man James Harden on a bad hamstring with his two buddies. I mean the Spencer Dinwiddies of the world who are seizing the, LeBron-fueled empowerment in their own way and being kind of the non-LeBrons to flex on the Nets or on the NBA and do their own thing. And I think you're only going to see more guys following in those footsteps. And you're already seeing that with, young guys getting paid and not having to be taken advantage of by the NCAA or the NBA.
Why is Spencer Dinwiddie the star of your book?
He's not the star. I mean, KD and Kyrie are the stars. I think Spencer knows how to get good press, but we also spent a lot of time having real talk about how he wasn't beholden to the Nets, how he was going to cash out, he was going to opt out of his contract no matter what, but he thought he was done when he tested positive and couldn't go to the bubble. He was fully ready, and he wears his heart on his sleeve, I think is why he's such an important character in the book, and he's not afraid to say, yeah, I think they're going to trade half the team and me for a superstar, whether that's Brad Beal or someone else. Like, he was ready to not be on the team, and then he got hurt, three games into the season or whatever, hurt his ACL, and I think he's gone to a Miami or the Clippers or something like that. But I love guys who don't care about what their employer thinks of them, don't necessarily care about what the superstars say about them, because usually guys are scared of the superstars and scared of their money and too scared to do, the real shit they want to do. Like the Jaylen Browns of the world, who probably would have knelt and not given a shit what the NBA said. But, the coin is still the king, and, he was probably worried about his rookie contract. So we're a lot of guys who wanted to boycott the bubble and not particularly interested in taking a knee in a Black Lives Matter t-shirt on a Black Lives Matter court in the bubble. But, sometimes you gotta secure the bag before you are willing to be yourself out loud.
He seems super interesting to me, not just because of wanting part of his contract in cryptocurrency, not just because he opted out a lot of money with Brooklyn just now, but also because of this GoFundMe where the second highest donation was $69 from a Nets fan who added the message, the Knicks are poopy poop butt soup.
That's how deep I went, Dan, is I interviewed that guy for 45 minutes and then told Spencer about it that day. So like I was, when I say this guy was thinking or Spencer was believed that, like I literally was recounting the side of the conversation with Poopity Poop Butt, who's like some Google engineer, Nets super fan, and then asked Spencer what he thought. And then like the next day, the Black Lives Matter protests are starting in the streets of Brooklyn, and I'm out there with a guy. And so, Tim Luau Cabarrón was probably saying something he shouldn't have said about how, his GM or whatever management in Philly didn't want him to take a knee, and so they're hugging and holding arms and shit. But that's what you get when you're willing to have real talk with these guys and dribble a basketball down Flatbush Avenue for 3 hours in 100-degree heat.
Wait a minute. You have said a lot of bombshell things during this interview, but you just alleged publicly you're willing to stake your journalistic credentials on Poopity Poop Butt Soup is an engineer of some sort.
He's a great Nets Nets Twitter superfan. The Nets have some very smart, you know, hipster Brooklyn fans to go with their ride or die jersey fan base.
I think the shit you're saying is crazy. Like, I'm sure the audience is lapping up every bit of this. I've got a smiling Stu Gotts next to me thinking about reading a book.
I mean, Matt, you're either
about reporting.
Matt, you're either the next Jay Glazer or the next Steve Glass, and I feel like there's no in between.
You got so there's this honesty. Nobody knows any of the shit you're talking about. It's all secrets.
I guess not anymore. I'm hoping that people take this, you know, at face value and realize that real sports journalism in the NBA is hard to come by. And I mean, you guys obviously know that, you know, ESPN keeps a pretty buttoned up version of this stuff, despite the occasional flourishes of journalism. But in this Zoom world, the players are controlling exactly what they want to say and don't have to answer any follow-up questions, don't have to do any real one-on-ones unless it's for, you know, the awkward, you know, Rachel Nichols interview or the second quarter thing where you're missing the action and Steve Nash is trying to get through the interview as fast as possible. But it's hard for real writers who aren't the top, you know, five or six national writers to get close to these people. And there's propaganda in press conference Zooms. And to some extent, there's propaganda in feeding stuff to Woj and Shams and Chris Haynes, who are great. But, you know, these guys have relationships to protect, and I clearly am, you know, letting bygones be bygones.
What did you learn about James Harden?
He kind of came in toward the tail end of my book. I learned how to come up with, I think, 13 different jokes about beard size, which I put in at the kind of last minute, to be honest, when the trade went down, and I kind of saw it coming right before my deadline. I think it's cool that he's been friends with KD, you know, consulting with him on the 2016 Warriors decision, and that he really was up in the gym, you know, in November, late October, early November, in this kind of Nets World West at Kobe's secret gym, where the guys came back ready for the next season. And it seems by all accounts that that's where KD especially was really doing the hard recruiting, instead just like, get in Nets World, get in there now. And so on election day, when the world seemed kind of upside down, these guys were low-key hooping in Kobe's gym and changing, you know, the course of the politics of super teams.
What did you learn about how Harden ended up there that people don't know beyond what you've already said?
I think that's kind of it. I let the Harden trail play out for beat reporters to, I guess, not really find out. My deadline was really right there. So I'm not going to, you know, spread any fake news about stuff that I don't know, because, you know, my reporting was contained to this insane historic season from the clean sweep through election day, basically, when it looked like the Harden trade was going to go down, and you know, the Jared Allens and Torian Princes and Caris LeVerts of the world were kind of looking over their shoulder wondering, you know, how many more hours am I going to be playing basketball with these guys. And at the same time, you know, I looked at 10 years worth of history, but I kept an eye on the Nets all this season. And I think just being able to look in the slipstream where NBA reporters weren't is how I saw this anthem thing. I don't want to project my, you know, political beliefs or anything onto these guys, because, you know, I think it's their choice to do a lot of these things and to flex their power or to skip the anthem. And I'm just trying to put it out there and put together some of those, you know, eerie parallels that came from Eric Garner, I Can't Breathe, to protest outside Barclays and Kyrie, you know, telling his fans to tell your senators to, you know, arrest the cops who killed Breonna Taylor and buying a house for George Floyd. These are who these guys really are. Like, I think the George Floyd thing in the house, like, got out there while I was keeping everything under embargo, but I knew a lot of this stuff for a while. And I think if my credibility is questioned because I haven't been out there, you know, writing stories every day about the NBA, that's fine. But I hope people will read this thing in their full context, because that was my promise to KD, to Kyrie. And I'm sure what they talk about with James and other people is that, like, this is what this guy said this was going to be. You know, I didn't make any promises to be nice.
Beyond what you've already told us, what do you think sports fans or basketball fans are going to find most shocking to learn, because they haven't learned how antiseptic the reporting in the NBA actually is, because you can't really usually get close to these guys?
I think it's how a lot of the slightly older, lower paid guys are pretty fed up with the NBA machine. Someone like Wilson Chandler was really fascinating to me in, you know, being stuck, you know, through the China stuff, where, like, he said, you know, you know, how you feel about this, how you feel about that when we're stuck in the China situation. But then when we're here, it's like, you don't want us to talk about politics and fucking human rights and black rights. And, you know, he was questioning, again, how woke the NBA was, right? And I think he says, you know, they've seen all the backlash that the NFL got. So they're like, well, we can't be the NFL, but we also can't go all the way over to this left side either. We got to be a little bit more progressive, make it seem like we have total freedom of speech. But don't kneel. That's in your contract that you can't. So don't kneel. But you can have freedom of speech. So, you know, when I was talking to Wilson about whether he was going to go in the bubble, he was like, hell no. You know, it won't be powerful. Just the, you know, he's texting me this stuff in real time while Kyrie's, you know, writing manifestos on Instagram in the middle of all this George Floyd stuff. And Wilson's saying, like, it's just the NBA and Nike capitalizing off another tragedy, branding it its finest. Shit is a plantation. So I think these guys feel a little trapped by the empire. And I respect Kyrie calling that out and saying, you know, it's just more ESPN and NBA stuff exploiting our likeness, exploiting our image. And so I don't want to be some like woke white dude out here, you know, exploiting the truth for book sales. Like, to me, it was never about the book sales. A portion of this stuff's going to go to the victims of families of gun violence. I wanted to give these guys the room to speak in deeper context about how they are human beings and they have their own views. And if that means that the NBA system needs to change in order to adapt to them, I hope that those non-LeBrons kind of get what they've been searching for as the next generation comes up.
What did you learn about Kobe Bryant? Because some of your reporting about this year, the pandemic weirdness started with that grief. And that's something that reached throughout the league in a lot of different emotional and interesting places.
The book actually starts with Kyrie getting on Kobe's helicopter. This is back after the Celtics lost to the Bucks in 2019, Kyrie is seeking career advice on, you know, beyond the game, but also X's and O's. And then I got in the room shortly thereafter at Kobe's gym, where he had this kind of all-star seminar. You know, Kawhi was there, Tobias, Kai, and they're having real talk about, you know, again, that unvarnished Kobe vibe that I think has, you know, crept into a lot of this generation after him. And, you know, Kyrie's talking about, you know, Brad Stevens, he has a bunch of rules, but I'm like, okay, this is actually what we're running, and we got to be great within this. And, you know, I think what's interesting about Kobe is he would indulge that, but he would also take the high road. And he would say, I think he said in response to that in the room while Kyrie was eating another vegan sandwich, he's a big sandwich guy. You know, he said that Phil Jackson taking credit for a matchup switch that helped the Bulls get to the finals once, and Jordan didn't care, so why should you care? And Kobe said, at the end of the day, you do it, you figure it out, you win, and the coach gets paid. You're welcome. So that Mamba mentality was real. But I also think Kobe, as we've all come to learn, had that kind of girl dad vibe that he was finding, you know, sadly late in his life. And I think that's what struck a chord more than the Black Mamba with Kyrie. And he wants to really pick up the pieces. And I think a lot of the, you know, viral videos of Kyrie speaking about Kobe after his death were me asking very long-winded, hardcore, serious, kind of depressing questions in the scrum when everybody else was just asking about his, you know, 54-point game after Kobe died. But, you know, Kobe was up in Kyrie's head, you know, before the shot in game 7. You know, Muhammad Ali died that week and they were talking about that. And he's also like, don't forget to tuck your right elbow. Don't forget to tuck your right elbow. And that's what he did when he hit the shot. He had Kobe in his head. And to see Kobe's presence, you know, obviously it was that terrible day when the tragedy occurred. Kyrie just left the gym. He went home. And instead of watching the Nets play the Knicks that day, he just watched Kobe highlights, the 81-point game. And I think it was really, really hard for Kyrie. And, you know, his trainer told me that he was worried that day would be the last time Kyrie was ever in an NBA arena again, that he would just straight up retire. Now, I think, you know, that can be exaggerated. Kyrie said, I can see myself going off in a cloak and growing my fro out in the mist of the mountains, kind of like, remember that Sopranos episode the last season when he goes off with the hooker into the Vegas mountains. But I think that's a bit of a stretch. But I think, you know, Kobe did have that mystical appeal to everybody, but also would text teenagers, like teenage girl hoopers and all-stars alike. And I think that's really rubbed off on Kyrie, while we'll see a different Kyrie at the memorial for Kobe, which is like this huge A-list Oscar style, you know, GOAT Hall of Fame gathering. Everybody's kind of mingling afterward in the in the tunnel, and Kyrie just walks out onto the streets of Los Angeles on the sidewalk and is just talking with the girls from Gigi's team, just being there for him. And so he's a real one. I think he gets a lot of that from Kobe, and I think Kobe, you know, will really see the good spirit of a lot of these, you know, these kind of mentees of his, and as the professor's legacy carries on very much off the court.
You did a hell of a job selling your book, Matt. The book is called Can't Knock the Hustle, Inside the Season of Protest.
A hell of a job writing his book.
You might have done a hell of a job or a hell of a job not selling it, because you gave us everything.
Yep.
Matt, thank you.
There's more in there. I was going to say the title of the book again to help him sell the book, and neither of you would help me do that. Can't
I already
knock
read it.
The Hustle, Inside the Season of Protest, Pandemic, and Progress with the Brooklyn Nets Superstars of Tomorrow. It is available now. It is a very long title.
It's too long. I agree. But Stugatz, I think the book is kind of long, but you can get the audiobook. My narrator is very good. He has better voice than I do.
The audiobook. I don't need it. I mean, you just gave it to me.
Thank you, Matt.
Delightful.
We appreciate
you guys.
Sir.
Keep fighting the good fight on the pirate ship.
Hey folks, this is a special